The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Good evening. Welcome to The Money Show. I'm Bruce Whitfield. It is a Friday night and The Money Show is brought to you by Absa Commercial Property Finance. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. It's good to have you with us. Coming up on our Friday file later on, a wonderful Cape Town startup. Started in 2015. Two women got together. One very arty and creative, another very process driven and accounty. And they've created a business called Cape Island and luxury focus at about 20 to 7, just before the Brutal Biz quiz, is all about Cape Island, a fantastic Cape Town business. And it really is got a lovely market. It is, it's done very well. So we'll talk to them about that, to Karen Wood from Cape Island. Also this evening, Moody's is delivering its latest prognosis on the economy. We're also this evening going to be looking at the post office and its desire to be the sole distributor of parcels that are under 1 kilogram in weight. We've seen a huge burgeoning, of course, of the courier industry over the last 20 years as the post office became increasingly incapable of doing the basic job of delivering post. And now they're saying, hold on a second, but we want to have this monopoly. I will talk to a lawyer of Postnet. Postnet is at risk, of course, should it lose the right to deliver parcels of under a kilogram. So we'll pick up on that story coming up this evening as well here on The Money Show.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
We'll chat to Kim Silberman in a moment. Kim is with RMB, and it's all about tonight's Moody's discussion. Moody's, of course, one of the three ratings agencies that is absolutely pivotal in deciding whether or not South Africa should be investment grade or not. And after many, many months of delays, we were finally pushed to sub-investment grade in March last year as we went into hard lockdown. And we are, according to Moody's, two levels below investment grade, and they are not going to be taking us into investment grade anytime soon. But are they going to be making any more positive noises, I wonder, about the actions that are being taken by National Treasury to try and keep spending under control and to grow the economy? Those are the critical ones. We'll see that in just a moment. Follow that with Anton Roots, who's a director at Norton's Incorporated. He is the lawyer for Postnet. Good evening and welcome to The Money Show. The JSE racking up a three-day winning streak, came within a fraction of a percentage point of a record today. More on that with David Peacock at Sunland Private Wealth this evening. The move came ahead of the latest review by Moody's of our country's finances. Moody's, of course, two levels below junk. Most analysts not expecting a change. Kim Silberman is fixed income and currency analyst at Rand Merchant Bank. Are you expecting any change in either the rating or the outlook, Kim?
Good evening. No, I'm not. I think it will remain BA2 with a negative outlook.
Okay, and what does that mean? I mean, it means we're two levels below junk. It's a bit like Goldilocks. We're not doing, we're not too hot, not too cold. We're bumbling along just fine, or worse than that?
Well, I mean, I don't think we're bumbling along just fine. So in the forecast that Moody's gave us earlier in the year, they do not expect debt to stabilize. So that means, our financial situation in terms of the fiscus is not sustainable, and it's only a matter of time before we downgrade it if we carry on as we are.
Now, many people say, well, why should we worry about that, Kim? We're already in junk status, but a bit like, grey has got 50 shades, ratings agencies got multiple levels of downgrade. And the further you go into the downgrade mire, the harder it is to come out and to get this great status of investment grade.
Yeah, I mean, what happens is, I suppose it's a cycle, a vicious cycle, where the as you move from a double B to a single B, you're in a different world of investors, and that means that your yield is structurally higher. It means there's less investors out there that will look to buy up our debt, and it means our debt service costs will just go up. And at the moment, they're already the fastest growing component of expenditure and are increasingly unsustainable. So Moody's expects interest on debt to reach around 7.8% at the end of the forecast period, whereas growth, nominal growth, will only be 5.3%. So very simply, the rule of thumb is if nominal GDP equals your interest costs, then you can reach a sustainable fiscal environment. With SA, nominal GDP at 5.3 and interest at 7.8, you can see that gap is moving in the wrong direction. So
yeah, our interest rates have been high ever since Nhlanhla Nene got fired, and our fiscal situation has deteriorated over a decade and continues to deteriorate, and exacerbated then by COVID-19. And you can say, well, COVID-19 wasn't our fault, but we're also not taking the proactive steps to restore the country's finances, to get growth going, so that we can therefore get the income we need to bring the debt under control. And we're not cutting our spending very aggressively either.
Well, I don't know if I would possibly disagree with you on the spending front. I mean, I think government or Treasury has forecast that we're going to cut spending over the next 3 to 4 years by 500 billion. 300 billion of that is from wages, and the rest is mainly from infrastructure. So I think there's a massive cut, actually, in spending. To the point where the cut in spending may even affect the extent to which we grow. Obviously, government spending is part of the growth story. So I think, on the spending front, we are cutting spending. Our real problem, as you mentioned, is growth. So we aren't going to be able to stabilize our debt through cutting expenditure. It's only through increasing our growth rate that we're going to get to a sustainable fiscal position.
And the language, I guess, that Moody's uses tonight will be significant. I mean, it'll give us an indication as to when the next move in ratings is going to be.
Correct. And I do think, they're looking for signs that they can hang their hat on. So I think with respect to the wage negotiations, they will look at whether those move in a positive direction in terms of consolidation. I think also revenue, the budget deficit came in 51 billion better in the previous fiscal year than was projected in the February budget. So they may actually reduce their deficit figures slightly, and debt to GDP is going to be on a slightly lower trajectory than what they'd forecasted previously. So we could see a bit of positive news coming out of the projection that Moody's makes in their review this evening. So that's part of why I don't think they'll change their outlook. But unfortunately, they are at the margin, and they don't change the fact that we're not sustainable at the moment in terms of our fiscal position.
Kim Silberman, thank you. The fixed income and currency analyst at RMB. So no big change expected this evening, which is nice. Markets certainly behaved today as if nothing was ever going to change. And in fact, the JSE is higher today. The Rand is stronger than before we went into junk territory. But here's the concern. If we don't get the growth going and we don't actually get those wage negotiations successfully concluded, we then see the fiscal standing of South Africa deteriorate and we move further into junk. And it's really, really tough, and it's rough. But we got ourselves into this position. It's nobody else's fault. Nobody else's fault at all. We're talking about the US jobs numbers this evening with David Peacock. They created fewer jobs than expected last month, despite the huge stimulus package in the United States that saw the American government send $1,400 in checks to most Americans. They added 266,000 jobs in April, which we would kill for, of course, literally and figuratively. But it wasn't as high as had been hoped, and the unemployment rate actually edged up a little bit to 6.1%. There's still just under 10 million people unemployed in the United States, which historically is high for them, but considerably better than the number of 20 million in May last year. The US reduces jobs very, very quickly, cuts people loose, and then rehires as things recover very, very quickly too. But we haven't seen unemployment rate to the levels it was just before the crisis, the COVID crisis. Unemployment is at about, 3.5% or thereabouts.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Bless state-owned enterprises. They really want monopolies on what they do. The airports company, I think, has probably done the best of those sort of monopolistic entities as a monopoly that has run the biggest airports. And I think it's done quite well at that, although having a monopoly has enabled it to price almost a level, almost unfettered pricing in terms of airport taxes. They disagree with that statement, but it's my view. We've seen the likes of the SABC, for example, which had a broadcast monopoly, which the Kirshes, the people who started this company, broke by using apartheid legislation against the National Party and broadcasting from Bophuthatswana, of course. But you still have to pay a TV license if you have a TV, whether you watch SABC channels or not. And the SABC, of course, wants a fee attached to any digital devices now because you're able to stream content, broadcast content. Even if you don't watch SABC channels on your digital device, they still want to charge you a license fee. The latest in this sort of attempt of the state wanting to be at the middle of everything is the Post Office, which says it has actually got, in terms of law, exclusive rights to deliver parcels weighing 1 kilogram or less. Now, if the Post Office is successful in enforcing the law there, a 20 billion rand private courier industry could be absolutely devastated in. You might never receive a package under 1 kilogram again. Anton Roots is the lawyer and director at Norton's Incorporated. I mean, this isn't about the capability of the Post Office to do its job. It's about the letter of the law here, Anton. And you're fighting on behalf, I think, of PostNet in this matter.
That's right, Bruce. No, that's right. I mean, Bruce, essentially the heart of this matter is, does the Post Office have a monopoly over the couriering of items with a weight of less than 1 kilogram?
The law says it does, doesn't it?
No. That's a point where we have a difference of view from the Post Office. The Post Office, okay, of course, says it does. We say it doesn't. On a proper interpretation of the Postal Services Act. I think the second thing is we also think that if the Post Office's argument was correct, that would have various constitutional implications. It would infringe on freedom of expression. It would infringe on privacy and dignity. Essentially, you would be required to use the services of a state-owned enterprise when you're not sure whether or when the thing is going to arrive that you want to send.
So hold on a second. How do you get, sorry, Anton, I mean, you're a lawyer, yeah, how do you get from the right to deliver a package under 1 kilogram to freedom of expression and rights to privacy? Please explain.
No, absolutely, please. I mean, it's very, I think the thing is that one needs to take a step back. So, you know, when we think of courier of things of less than a kilogram, we obviously think of the obvious kind of things. You get your credit card delivered to you by the bank. You get, if you apply for a visa, your passport sent back to you. You leave your keys behind in Cape Town, they get couriered back to you. So we think of those kind of things. We think of e-commerce. We think of small parcels you might get from Yuppie Chef and Take a Lot. But what you might also well send by post by courier is sensitive documents. I write you a letter. I want to say something in that letter which I'm expressing myself in a particular way. I want that letter to come to you by a particular service. I'm now being compelled on the Post Office's argument to rely on a state-owned enterprise to do it, which may or may not get it there within the time that I want. So that is an aspect of freedom of expression.
These are all important issues, and it comes down to the capability of the Post Office. I mean, if the Post Office won this case and it was suddenly expected to do it, but does the law care about these ancillary issues? Does the law care about whether the Post Office is capable or incapable? Surely the job of the court is to interpret the law. The Post Office has one interpretation and you have another. In the cold light of day, is it not just the letter of the law that matters? How much flexibility would a court have to consider all of these additional arguments?
No, Bruce, I think there are obviously two aspects. The one aspect is, let me look at the act as it stands and I interpret that. And obviously the Post Office's version, we have a version. But when you look at which one to prefer, you must also look at, does the Post Office's argument infringe on constitutional rights? If it does, then you're going to try and interpret in favor of our argument. I think there is one aspect, Bruce, maybe that sort of ties the practical and the legal things together, which is rationality. And one of the points that we argued before the ICASA's Complaints and Compliance Committee is we said at that point, the CEO, I think it was Mark Barnes, said, in the commercial operations of SAPA, including all mail, parcels, e-commerce, and courier business, SAPA has regressed so far technologically that it simply cannot offer a competitive service. So essentially what we're being asked as South Africans to do is then to rely on an enterprise which itself says that it cannot offer a competitive service. And I think, I mean, you know, ask me as a sort of a non-legal person, if in a, putting myself in a non-legal thing, that just doesn't sound rational to me.
Got you.
And
again, if you want to send a letter to somebody and you want to use a particular courier, well, you put in, I don't know, a kilogram of something, maybe half a brick. I don't know how much a brick weighs, and you send your letter. But that does seem to defeat the purpose of efficiency. Anton Roots, thank you, the lawyer and director at Norton's Incorporated, representing the guys at Postnet, as this battle heats up. It's a really interesting battle. I mean, this is a post office fighting for survival, of course, but it's let us all down so incredibly badly for so incredibly long that the private sector has made up for its ineptitude, for its incompetence, for its failure. And as a result of that, we have this remarkable courier network. I wish the post office, I wish I could trust the post office. I wish I could rely on the post office. I resent having to pay courier fees to do simple deliveries. It really upsets me. I wish the post office was better at its job, but it's not. Fix yourself, post office, then bring the arguments.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Well, a spectacular day on markets. A remarkable day on markets. Very, very close to record levels, within about 200 points of record levels. The JSE was buoyant. It was vibrant. It was exciting. It was positive. The currency recovered. David Peacock at Sanlam Private Wealth. It was a lovely day. And considering where we were this time last week and how we started this week, it's a really nice surprise.
Yeah, well, Bruce, I must say I haven't heard you this upbeat in a long time. We definitely had a very good end to the week, and we've had a couple of strong days. So, you know, funny enough, you know, as you mentioned earlier in your show, we've obviously got the Moody's review, which will probably come out either later today or during the weekend. And then obviously the S&P, I think they having a look at us in, I think on the 21st of May. So currency looking strong. That's, the currency has improved by 25% so far in the last year. So good performance there. Interestingly enough, you know, I think that we really followed on from the US and international markets, because effectively, you know, those payrolls numbers came out, you know, significantly worse than expected. So, you know, we saw sort of 266,000 jobs as opposed to 1 million that was expected. So clearly it's a case of bad news is good news, particularly in the U.S., because, you know, effectively that means that interest rates are probably going to stay lower for longer, and the juice bowl that is out there, you know, in terms of stimulating the economy is going to continue. So, you know, from that perspective and listening to the sort of comments from the Fed in terms of, you know, their policies really outcomes-based, you know, they're looking at obviously labor inflation at sort of 2%, and then, you know, see how those move through. And then at that stage, you know, start looking at, normalizing interest rates. So in this case, you know, let's enjoy it as we can.
And the only thing that worries me, and I was looking at this, I hadn't looked at the price earnings multiple, which is a slightly boring technical way of seeing how expensive the market is. For a long time, the market was trading between 10 and 12 times last year's profits. At the moment, it's trading at 24 times last year's profits. That's twice as expensive as it was when it was cheap. And by historical standards, 24 is a big and high and quite scary number, isn't it?
Yeah. Look, Bruce, that clearly is one of the concerns at the moment, is that we are seeing elevated valuations where ultimately in terms of why those valuations are there, not because of the fact that the economy is performing as well as it is, it's because of the stimulus that is in the market. So, you know, if you look at the sort of numbers that we looked at early on this week, you are starting to see investors in, for example, equity funds and that sort of thing, particularly in the U.S., starting to move out of equities and you know, move more into sort of cash and that sort of thing. So that clearly that is a concern. But alternatively, the fact is that as long as the stimulus is in place and as long as the market believes that it's going to continue to be in place, you know, possibly through the second half of the year, possibly even into the third quarter of the year, you know, you're going to continue to get these inflated valuations.
So it's a little bit like going to a rodeo in Texas, and you get put on a big bucking bronco, and you just hold on for dear life, and, you know, if you can, enjoy the ride.
Bruce, you're very descriptive tonight.
Well, and you hold on to your hat, and you put one hand on the pommel and one hand above your head, and, you know, then start making cowboy noises.
Yeah, Bruce, I think one needs to start avoiding the bucking bronco because clearly you're just going to get hurt. So, you know, I think what you're seeing starting to happen is obviously the IT sector has been very strong, and you see that performance coming through again. But, you know, there clearly is a view, and it's our view as well, that you're starting to see a bit of rotation into, for example, some of the value stocks. Because ultimately, you know, if you look at, for example, the South African market, you know, you've had a number of valuations of SA Inc. stocks that have been remarkably low. Sort of small cap stocks, which unfortunately are difficult to trade because of the tradability, but you've seen decent value in a lot of these value stocks. And I think what you'll start seeing is you'll start seeing rotation over time into, for example, you know, some of the sort of cheaper stocks in the market, and hopefully that'll take a bit of the pressure off the market, a bit of steam off the market.
Hold on to your hat. David Peacock, thank you, Portfolio Manager at Sunlam Private Wealth.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Commercial Property Finance, committed to delivering innovative solutions for groundbreaking developments. That's African Nacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
Welcome to The Money Show. I see capitalism is being tested everywhere. I mean, it's deeply flawed, but sometimes it does allow you to show your disapproval in a way that many other systems don't. Totalitarianism allows you to shoot your enemies, but capitalism is a bit more civilized than that. The mining giant Rio Tinto's faced a shareholder revolt over a $10 million bonus package for its outgoing chief executive. 61% of votes cast at the annual general meeting opposed the executive remuneration package. And the backlash is after the Rio Tinto destroyed a sacred Aboriginal rock shelter in Western Australia last May. They blew up a 46,000-year-old rock shelter in a place called the Yukon Gorge to expand an iron ore mine. And it led to a huge outcry, and it led to several resignations at the company. And now the shareholders are saying you cannot just behave in that way. And despite the shareholder rebellion, though, you know, you can be as outraged as you like, and 61% of your shareholders can vote against your remuneration, but executives still expected to receive their payouts. The vote is an advisory one only, but it's a gradual process, and at some point shareholders have got to be able to have the right to vote against their CEO remuneration. I remember in the early days of executive remuneration being made public, and outraged by some executives and saying, you know, why should one of them, I can't remember who it was for the life of me, but one of them said to me, why should some woman who lives in Hoedspruit be able to vote against what I get paid? She doesn't understand what I do. And I said to him, but she's your shareholder. And he looked at me as if I was the stupid one. Thank goodness times have moved on a little bit. Doesn't matter where you live or what your job is, if you own shares in the company, you get a vote. Hopefully that vote gets strengthened and that, you know, companies are held more to account by their shareholders.
The Money Show.
The Friday File.
The Friday File.
Heads up, if you didn't know, Sunday is Mother's Day. If you've been getting lots of hints and suggestions and little nudges and you've been gracefully ignoring them, welcome to the world. Today's Friday File designed to help you in an emergency if you have failed to plan. Karen Wood is co-founder and finance director at Cape Island. Now, Cape Island is a 2015 startup. It provides some seriously beautifully packaged products, wonderfully scented candles, fragrances, room sprays, glorious luxury products. That 2015 date, Karen Wood, take me back to it with your co-founder. What was the big motivation to get it all started?
Hi, Bruce. It's great to be on the show. I think for us, Cape Island has always been a dream about celebrating this beautiful country that we live in. So when we first started the company back in 2015, that was our driving force. You know, we both lived overseas for a few years and missed our homeland and really just wanted to be able to tell a story, because I think people really enjoy stories. And, you know, it's been the basis of our growth, and the different fragrances that we've launched into the market has been celebrating and telling the story of this beautiful place that we call home.
I wasn't aware of you at the very beginning, but I mean, did you start out with just candles? Did you start out with the whole range? What were the first products that you launched?
We actually started out a little bit in the textile industry, doing sort of cushions and bags and stuff, and had one beautiful candle that just sold incredibly well, and realized that that was where our passion and vision lied. So we sort of, I'd say, launched our more extended fragrance range towards the end of 2016, and it's just grown exponentially from there. I think our sixth fragrance, Wild Coast, was launched at the end of last year, and we're already starting to conceptualize the next one.
I was quite surprised by the extent of the candles, because I look at candles, I think it's quite a crowded market. There are lots of imports,
yeah.
Lots of people make candles locally, but you seem to have hit a sweet spot. I mean, it's a lot to do with branding, but yes, the fragrances are important, but the packaging is so beautiful that actually, they're luxury, but they become affordable luxury, you know, given in the right sort of context and in the right sort of way.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, for us, it's been a delicate balance. We are a smaller business in South Africa. We're competing against bigger brands and obviously a lot of sort of international imports that come into the country. But I think our passion is shown in the product that we produce. We wanted to make it attainable for people to buy and enjoy in their homes. And we do all of our conceptualizing and design in-house. We really are almost like a family business. We sit around the table and really throw our hearts and souls into it, and I think that's what you see in the end product.
How do you create a fragrance? I mean, I've been to Grasse in the south of France, and I've seen the process of, you know, pressing the flowers to get the frangipani and all of these sorts of beautiful scents. But how do you sit and how do you try and create a fragrance, a unique fragrance, yet one that is going to be, you know, something that doesn't put customers off? And it's, you know, you've got to sort of approach a mass market, yet be unique at the same time in a market where there's a lot of competition.
No, absolutely. Creating a fragrance is a story of trial and error and a lot of time. We obviously have amazing international fragrance suppliers, so all of our essential oil fragrances are imported from France. But we sit and we do a drop of this and a drop of that, and we start envisaging again that we take it back to the story. What are we wanting this fragrance to evoke in people when they smell it? Now, fragrance is obviously a very personal thing, and everyone experiences it slightly differently. But that's why we've expanded our range across the different fragrances, and people will always have their favorite that sort of takes them back. I think fragrance is a great... It takes you back to memories or things that were important in your life. So we sit around, we have got some incredible expert advisors that give us advice as well, but we potter a little bit and come up with something that we think is beautiful and that we can put our sort of our hearts behind.
And the nice thing about it is you don't need to take it to a committee. You don't need to take it to a board of directors, because it's just really two of you in charge. And you can say, we like this, and let's see if the market likes it. And very quickly you'll learn whether or not it's going to function or not. Have you had done trial and error, or has everything that you've put in market landed well?
We definitely have some that are sort of favorites and bestsellers, and others that have taken a slower time to, you know, take up in the market. We've learned sometimes that we need to tweak things slightly, which we can always do. But, we're an all-female business, and we have 20 employees now. So we have a lot of in-house trial and error to be done with different people. families get involved and all the rest.
Oh, God. Then the fights. Hand sanitizer became the great thing. I mean, Charlotte Rees jumped on the hand sanitizer bandwagon. You did that as well. You can't not be providing a hand sanitizer in COVID times. That's an absolute important range as well. Talk to me about distribution, because getting distribution, particularly as a small business, is incredibly difficult. And we were just talking earlier about the failure of the post office, and it's not like you could put a package in the post at your local post office and have it delivered to Joburg in a week or two. It may never get there. So you end up having to courier stuff, and that comes at huge additional expense. How have you managed distribution of product? Because a lot of it's pretty big and quite heavy.
Yes, absolutely. And I think the thing we struggle with is our products are quite fragile as well. So we need to make sure they're carefully packaged. We have worked for a long time with some amazing local courier companies who we've developed long-standing relationships with and who want to sort of help us achieve client and customer service, which is after all what it's all about. So yeah, we have an established relationship with couriers who do all of our local distribution for us. And we're also starting to export, so they're helping us with that part as well.
Because you've got a nice strong retail presence in both Joburg and in Cape Town. How big is online for you? And I mean, have you noticed, is there a noticeable uptick courtesy of lockdowns and everyone's shift to more digital channels?
Yeah, we've certainly seen a big growth in our online market during COVID because obviously no one could get out into the shops, and that's been sustained. We've really put a lot of effort into our marketing and our digital media, and we have a fantastic team that puts a lot of thought into that. So we're definitely seeing that being a growing part of our market.
And it also would be a massive appeal to the tourist market. Have you taken a severe knock as a result of that? Because everybody, when they go to a place, wants to take home a memory. And if a candle evokes a memory, if you go to the south of France and you pick up a beautiful fragrance candle, it reminds you of your holiday. Or Mauritius, you bring back a vanilla candle or whatever the case is, and it smells like the resort. I'm assuming that market was good for you.
Absolutely. It was definitely something that we launched into very strongly when we first started the business. And we still get frequent emails from people all over the world saying they bought a Cape Island candle when they're on holiday in Cape Town. How can they get some more? So, yes, we did see a downturn in trade during COVID because of the tourism market. But we've had incredible support from local retailers. It's really actually been amazing. And we really reached out to them during COVID to try and build a stronger relationship. You know, it's all about partnership and collaboration when you're going through an experience like that. And I think that really helps sustain us,
I mean, your ranges are amazing. I mean, from candles, so from fabrics are gone, but you've still got wrapping papers and things like that. You've got really nice wide range of products. Do you look to diversify further? Do you maybe go back to the fabrics at some point? Or is it purely going to be fragrance-related and soaps and things like that?
I think we're stuck on fragrance now, definitely for the future. And we have an incredible creative team. So I'm sometimes the one saying, slow down, guys. The ideas, we've got lots of ideas that we want to put out there into the market. So definitely fragrance is the way to go for us.
Karen Wood, thank you very much for chatting. Good luck. Thank you. Co-founder and financial director at Cape Island, the fun police of Cape Island. I mean, it's just, have a look at the website, capeisland.co.za. Lovely range of products. It's Mother's Day. But yeah, and it's just lovely to see passionate people starting projects like this and really growing businesses and expanding their businesses and employing 20 people. It's significant. If every small business could employ 20 people, we'd have a far smaller unemployment problem in South Africa. On the idea of paying people for the work they do, Twitter has launched something new. It's a tip jar feature. It allows you to send money to other people on social media. So if you follow somebody and they either inform you or amuse you, you can reward them financially for doing it. The company says the feature is the easy way to support incredible voices that make up conversations. And they've had a select group of people, a couple of journalists, a couple of creators of content, experts, non-profit organizations. But nothing ever comes without controversy, of course, because many of the payment providers like PayPal or Venmo and in the United States, Cash App are some of the more popular means of payment in the United States. But because it's made through external systems, some Twitter users are noticing that tipping a PayPal account, for example, lets the recipient know the postal address of the tip sender. So they've got to work on the privacy aspects of this, of course. But yeah, it's a nice, interesting new feature. Would you tip somebody for a tweet? It might improve the quality of the tweets. It might. I would like to know from you, please, in tonight's Brutal Biz Quiz as we move towards 7 o'clock. And of course, between 7 and 8, we'll bring you the best bits of The Money Show from the week that has been. But the Brutal Biz Quiz is coming up next. I would like to know from you, please, on 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567. What did Ace Magashule send to President Cyril Ramaphosa this week? Was it a bunch of flowers? Was it a letter of suspension? or was it his own letter of resignation? What did Ace Magashule send to President Cyril Ramaphosa this week? Flowers, a letter of suspension, or his own letter of resignation? 021-446-0567-011-883-0702. We started easy. We'll see whether or not we warm you up a little bit this evening. Give us a call if you want to play tonight's brutal biz quiz.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Commercial Property Finance, committed to delivering innovative solutions for groundbreaking developments. That's African Nacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
Brutal Biz Quiz on this Friday night. What did Ace Magashule send to President Cyril Ramaphosa this week? Flowers, a letter of suspension, or his own letter of resignation? Marion in Camps Bay in Cape Town.
He sent him a letter requesting him to resign.
Yeah, he sent him his own letter of suspension. After being suspended from the party, then Magashule reacted by sending President Cyril Ramaphosa a suspension letter. The ANC, of course, playing it all down. Now Magashule looking to unleash hell on the party. He's facing fraud and corruption and money laundering charges, but hell hath no fury like a politician suspended on full pay, Marion. Ebi Domisa has written a book about the rising fortunes of which demographic group in our democratic era?
Gosh. You've got me.
Oh, Marion. What a pity, Marion. Thank you very much for playing. Kumi in Centurion. Ebi Domisa has written a book about which demographic group, who's done very well, thank you, from democracy.
Sorry, Bruce, repeat that question, please.
Kumi, Ebi Domisa has written a book about the rising fortunes of which group in the democratic era?
Oh, shucks, I don't have the answer. I was calling in for the suspension letter.
You see, Kumi, but we move on. We move on. But thank you for playing. Hussein in Greenside. Rude, Hussein. Rude. Putting the phone down, that the gunk sound. Hurtful. Hussein. Yeah, I mean, Ebi Domisa has written the book, and it's about the rise and the rise of a particular group of tycoons. He was our guest this week at our book feature, and it looks at these particular business leaders, some really well-known individuals, particularly focused on one town, and how they've made their mark in the world of business amongst governments. Really big attempt to diversify the economy. Jeff in Cape Town.
It's the Afrikaners in Stellenbosch.
It is the Afrikaners. Not particularly in Stellenbosch, because Chris Becker doesn't live in Stellenbosch. He's more Paarl and in England. But yes, you're absolutely right. Afrikaners. People like Yanni Mutona, Michiel Leroux, and Chris Becker, and Christo Visser, and even Marcus Uster gets a mention, even though he's not that welcome at the mafia meetings. And the Confederation of African Football has been postponed. Till when? CAF's group phase for the Africa World Cup qualifiers has been postponed until when, Jeff? Pick a month.
December.
I'm afraid you're out, Jeff. We're not going to have time. Let's try. Hussein in Greenside's come back asking for forgiveness. Okay, Hussein. When does the CAF continue?
Sorry about it. I got cut off just now.
Hussein, quickly. Answer. A month.
No idea.
Pardon? No idea. Okay, don't pick a month then. Adrian in Parkview?
Can you repeat the question, Bruce?
No, I can't. That's the end of the biz quiz. I'm the winner. You're the losers. Got to listen closer. Sorry. Play it all again next week.